Accession number 8192, roll number 3.
Brigadier Barclay, reel 3. I think you were saying some of these raised positions were actually firing positions and not just for observation.
This is true. They were quite extraordinary and really seemingly ridiculous. Okay. They were quite extraordinary, these positions. They seemed ridiculous, really, but we were compelled to sight them right on this line of this anti-tank obstacle, this stream. And because no field of fire was possible on ground level, we had to build them up, which meant we had to create enormously high breastworks in front and a splinter-proof backdrop behind. Otherwise, they resembled trenches in trees. They were never used in the war at any stage, and I think people were thankful they didn't have to.
How did you actually build them up? What materials did you use?
Well, we had to make hurdles and stiffened up by either the lopped off trees themselves or else with great thick stakes and filled up with earth.
There's pick and shovel work.
Yeah, an immense amount of toil involved.
What did your men think of these positions?
Well, they're very philosophical about these sort of things. They did realise that unless they were raised up, they couldn't see them shoot any distance beyond this stream, and therefore there must be some form of merit in them. But I don't know what would have happened if they had been subjected to a severe artillery concentration, I must admit.
Did you have any wire to strengthen them?
Yes, we did. We had wire, and we used that a lot for this purpose. We didn't erect barbed wire on the other side of the stream because that was in Belgium. Nor did we, of course, lay mines. That was going to be done at the last moment. And
could you have mines in stock?
I don't know the answer to that, but I have little doubt they would be available.
Did your men do all the work in the construction of these positions?
Oh, all of it. All of it. Yes. There was a tremendous amount to do. I mean, we kept at it every day. There were always improvements you could make when you thought the job was nearly finished to make them more better worthy.
What sort of pattern were they laid out in, these positions?
Well, by and large, in sort of shallow or wide-angled V formations, each post. So each post would accommodate a section. And either on people firing from ground level or either firing from breaststroke level or they're firing from higher up in these ridiculous tree positions.
So it was a row of platoon redoubts, was it?
Yes, that's really what it boiled down to.
What width of front did you have to cover with your company?
I should say it was about 300 yards.
And how deep was your position?
About 300 yards, less, 200 yards.
So you were in a rough sort of rectangle?
Yes.
Of 300 to the front and
that's about it. That's about it.
Did the battalion have all its companies in a single line, or was
there
a reserve?
No. There was certainly one in reserve. I can't quite remember if we had three companies up and one back, or whether we had two companies up and two back. I think the former. I think we had three companies up and one company in reserve, because we had quite a considerable frontage to hold with a whole battalion.
So you had these V-shaped trenches, each one of which would hold, what, ten men?
Seven
men. So would the Bren gun be in a separate?
No, Bren gun would generally be in the position, in the centre.
So that would be, were these Vs, was the point of the facing towards the enemy?
Yes, the Vs were facing towards the enemy, wide-angle Vs facing towards the enemy.
So it was like an arrowhead formation
for
the attack?
Yes, right.
Who actually sighted these trenches and
I sighted them on a company level throughout the company. The exact design was left to the platoon commander, but the locality was I decided.
Did you have two platoons up and one to the rear?
Yes, I had two platoons up and one to the rear.
How were you supposed to communicate with battalion headquarters?
We had an 18 set, if I remember right, which was pretty unreliable, and of course we had our lines. I mean, the signals were forever rolling these wire lines out on these drums.
Were these your own regimental signalers?
Yes.
You didn't have any help from...
Not on a company level. I'm not sure we didn't have two brigade signalers at battalion headquarters. I wouldn't be sure about that.
What about the Royal Engineers? Did you ever see anything of them while you were doing this construction work?
The engineers?
Yes.
No. There was nothing that was done there which was beyond the scope of the infantry soldier.
Now, you said the stream was probably an effective anti-tank obstacle. Did you take any other measures against an attack by armour?
No, none.
What about artillery support? Were you aware of...
Well, I know nothing about that, except that our signal for fire from the artillery was done by very light. And if you were in a pickle, you fired up white over red over white or something.
So there was a series of codes for that, summing up fire support.
That's the only link we had with the artillery from four company position.
You didn't see them at all?
No.
Now, you mentioned you were on the far right of the line, which I seem to remember is the Grenadiers' post traditionally, and that you had the French to your right. Did you see anything of them?
But hardly anything. There was a staggering little... link with them. Looking back now, I think it's appalling that commanding officers didn't liaise more and the company commanders didn't liaise more. But they were very difficult to deal with. They were totally indrawn, and they resented anybody going over the sort of demarcation line. And there was no encouragement from their point of view to liaise. Which seems to be remarkable. I find that at other stages in the war.
So you didn't see anything of any French liaison officer?
No, not that I can recall at all.
Were there any social contacts with the French?
No, none.
Were you able to do any proper training while you were on the front?
Well, jolly little, because we were so busy digging these positions. We had to keep the chaps fit. We used to go on route marches at least once a week, and we used to have a recreational afternoon on Saturdays. But the officers used to have toots, but we never did any unit or subunit above company level, included training.
I'd like to talk a bit about domestic and other arrangements while you were on the front here. Where were you accommodated?
Well, the soldiers were accommodated in barns, and the officers were accommodated in farmhouses. There was no shortage of that type of accommodation, and we could keep our subunits together as a whole. I mean, at least one platoon had a barn. Sometimes there were two platoons to a barn. And then farmhouses in the immediate vicinity were the locations of company commander and platoon commanders, where the company sort of headquarter office and some farm outhouse.
Were the people living in this farm?
Oh, yes. All the farms were occupied.
How did you get on with the people who were running?
Oh, very well. Oh, very well, actually. We became great friends with all of them. And there was a good deal of sort of mutual back-scratching went on.
What do you mean by that?
Well, we could help them in certain ways. I have no doubt they got bits of compo ration every now and again, and they got help on the farm in little ways. And there was a very close feeling altogether with the farmers on whose lands we built it and the soldiers. There was one thing which did upset them a little bit, and that was when our trenches in the fields interfered with the tiled drainage system. And that did perturb them quite a lot for good reason.
Was there a lot of flooding in that area?
No. While we were there, no.
Was it the sort of land that might be?
Oh, yes. It was heavy land. And I think when that stream swirled a bit, it was liable to flooding.
By heavier land, I presume you mean it was clay?
Yes, it was fairly strong land, a bit of clay. Hard work to dig.
Was it open or was it cut up with hedges and woods?
Well, the fields didn't have hedges, but there were clumps of trees over here and there, and the country on the Belgian side of the stream was considerably closer, with sprinklings of copses about the place. But on the French side, it was mostly open fields with small clumps, and then, of course, groups of willow trees here and there.
Did you see anything of the people on the Belgian side of the frontier?
Occasionally we used to chat across the street. Yes, they were very interested and cooperative and warm.
So they were friendly as well?
Oh yes.
What about your food and drink while you were up?
Well, we lived on compo rations, which are fairly boring, but, I mean, adequate sustenance. I would admit we supplemented them quite a bit with results of shooting escapades. There were quite a few partridges about the place, there were a few pheasants about the place, there were quite a number of hares about the place, and there were several rabbits. And we went so to vary our diet. And the soldiers were very good at making most marvellous field ovens and making the best of them.
So you did your own cooking, you didn't eat with the family?
Yes, we did our own cooking, and we were totally self-supporting regarding that aspect.
Did you have a sort of little company officer's mess?
Yes, we did. The officers used to come to my little farm, and we used to have our meals there. And I can't remember. We had a company cook who used to sort of produce edible meals.
What about drink?
Well, we drank a little, actually. There was a beer issue every now and again. We occasionally had a bottle of wine, but it really entered very little into the sort of daily routine.
How did you keep the men occupied when they weren't actually working?
Well, that keeping morale high was terribly important, and one went to every possible means to achieve this. The fact that they were working hard and were busy all the time at something or another was the greatest help towards keeping morale high. I had a marvellous concert troupe within the company. We got out from England mouth organs and flutes and various articles of musical equipment like that, and supplemented by combs and cheese paring boards and things like that, we had a very effective company band, and we used to have concerts about twice a week, and the talent that used to emanate from the company itself was quite remarkable. The soldiers used to enjoy this very much, and they were envied much by the other companies in the battalion. We used to have a lot of guests come to enjoy it. But that did a lot of good. We had cross-country runs, we had football. We kept them busy in some way or another absolutely all the time. And morale was extremely high and stayed that way the whole way through that winter.
Did you have any officially provided entertainment?
Any?
Did you see anything of any ENSA concert parties or anything like that?
I don't think that it got weaving well enough by that time. I do remember ENSA parties, which were very, generally very different. But I honestly can't remember if they came to us there or not. I don't believe they did. I think maybe they came more to the back areas.
Was it possible for the soldiers to go off for an evening in town?
Anymore? No. None of that.
They were just kept in the front line?
Yes. Yes, there was no relaxation on that score.
Roughly what proportion of the battalion would actually be in the forward positions at any one time?
Well, we used to... We weren't manning these positions because there was no cause to do so. There was the whole of Belgium in between us and the Germans. But obviously we had... each platoon had a chap on guard through the night.
So you had sentries out?
Yes. But that was as far as we needed to go at that stage.
You didn't have a picket or a patrol?
Oh, yes, we did. We had roaming patrols each night, really to sort of safeguard all our kit and stuff.
Test the sentries?
Yeah, just that.
What about leave? Did the soldiers manage to get back to England at all?
We didn't have any leave in 1939, I know that. I think leave started in 1940. And what percentage were allowed away at any one time, I don't remember, but not very, very high, so we had probably like sort of 5%. But in the 39 era, there wasn't leave.
Did you manage to get away on leave at all?
I certainly... I find it hard to remember this phase of the war and the later phase of the war. I believe... Yes, I did. I came home on leave once before the balloon went up in May. For, I think, 4 days or something.
What about mail? Was there a good flow of...
Oh, that was very good, and that meant a lot. That meant a tremendous lot to soldiers. That was frightfully important. And that was very efficiently run. It meant a lot of work in the quartermaster department every day, besides the victualling and that.
Did you have a padre attached to the battalion?
Yes. We had a padre, and we used to have services every Sunday. We used to go around, that was a very important part of weekly routine.
Did he play an important part in dealing with welfare difficulties?
Oh, yes, he did. I think it was more important, in fact, for the platoon commander than company commander to help on that aspect of life than him, but every now and again they like to talk to him as well. But I think, by and large, it was on the platoon commander and the company commander level that welfare issues were helped over, if not settled.
Did you have a strong religious feeling in the regiment? Were the soldiers?
I would say average. I mean, they used to turn up in force for our services on Sundays. And I think, in fact, it was a company parade. But they did like them. There's no doubt about it.
Were they held actually in the open, or was there a building where?
Well, if the weather was warm, we had them in the open. If it was wet, we had them in the barns.
Were you able to keep in touch with what was happening in the wider world while you were?
Well, this is an aspect that, with hindsight, worries me a little. One is so absorbed in one's own little world that the broader picture seldom reared its head. And I think perhaps more should have been done on a higher level to keep us in the picture. I did feel a bit concerned at times that the aspect of the Corps involvement and the British Expeditionary Force involvement should have been made more known to us. But it wasn't so, and we didn't go out searching for further information. We were very absorbed in our own fairly parochial job.
Did you hear BBC broadcasts?
That I can't remember.
Or get
I think we must have. I think we must have.
What about newspapers? Did you get those?
Yes, we got those. But of course, they're always a bit late in the day.
Did they give a fair impression of what was going on, as far as you could tell?
No. No, the security was such that you want to go draw a little idea, really, about what we were up to. Any form of accurate comparison.
Did you have any visits from senior officers or from royalty or other?
Oh yes, we did. We did. We had a visit from the Prince of Wales. We had a visit from Winston Churchill. My company was visited more than any company because A, it was the right of the line, and B, we had these extraordinary tree positions which nobody else had ever seen before. And they were a point of considerable interest and comment, I may say.
What sort of comments passed by these distinguished visitors?
Well, they were just amazed. They were just amazed. I know the Prince of Wales reckoned they were to be compared with Machan, from which he'd shot a tiger in his earlier days, which had perched up in trees. But I mean, the likes of them had never been seen before, and I don't suppose they will be again. But we always used to start on the right of the line where these lifted up positions had been created, and then move along the front. It was it was much more fun when there was somebody outside the army than when there was some rather critical senior general who reckoned it was his job to find fault somewhere, however pushed he was.
Was that generally the attitude of generals, that they were there to make their mark? And
actually, I think we were jolly well off from a point of view of understanding and ability to cope. Gort's a fairly controversial figure in that there are a few people who think the Gort line was a sensible arrangement. But he was an extremely courageous man and a very nice man, and he was very nice to have about. And General John Dill, who was our corps commander, I think I'm right in saying, used to see a certain amount of us, altogether charming. And it was a pleasure to have them there. I mean, they knew what it was all about, whereas the outside the army visitors, you could load up with any amusing story. They're much happier to hear about that than discussing the finer points of your defensive position.
I think you were saying earlier that you had a visit from Winston Churchill.
We had a most entertaining visit from Winston Churchill, I may say. He was in tremendously good form, and he came along followed by an array of brass. And I had a little mongrel which had come over and joined me from Belgium, and we started off with a rat hunt, and she never left me after that. And we were walking along from one position to another, and she suddenly started barking at a pile of faggots. And Winston was most intrigued by this. He said, "A little sport, a little sport?" I said, "Yes, if we play it right." He said, "Well, let's play it right. How do you want it played?" So I said, "What we really want to do is get three officers on the top of that pile of faggots and have them bounce. And then we'll bolt the rabbit and then we'll have a hunt." So his eyes lit up, and the three senior generals were ordered onto this pile of faggots and directed by Winston, as it were, an orchestra conductor, he synchronized the bouncing, and sure enough, very shortly, the rabbit bolted, and we had a most exciting hunt, which intrigued Winston no end, and slightly confused the generals concerned.
How did the generals take to this gymnastics?
Well, they had no alternative. I mean, they were just ordered up there by Winston and told to bounce. They looked pretty foolish with their ADT sort of looking on to start with, I must say, but they entered the spirit of the thing, and they thoroughly enjoyed it when my little dog gave tongue and went hurtling off this rabbit. It was quite a change from the norm.
What did the men think of all these visitors coming round the position?
Well, they were very intrigued to see Winston. They were pretty intrigued to see the Prince of Wales, I must say, but they all thought the world of Winston, and it was a great day when he came, and he was marvellous with them, and wanted to know all about the interesting little things that were going on, and chatted to a lot of the soldiers, which gave them much pleasure.
I think that at some stage you were moved from this position and you were sent down to the Maginot Line.
Yes, that's right. This happened in early January, if I remember right, in 40. It was bitterly cold. We had about 40 degrees of frost, and it was so cold you couldn't dig trenches. You had to blow holes and then pick away and make a suitable position. And it was so cold we had to have a sort of hay sandbagged insulation round our arms and round our legs to keep circulation going. And the sentry work at night was a vicious business, but the soldiers were marvellous, and we never had any of them sick or sorry. But it was about the coldest winter I can remember. We moved up through the rear line, which is a lean de resistance, through the middle line, which is...